I'm Beverly. I'm an alcoholic. Yes, from Lancaster. Boy, that was a, I don't know. I've been on many rides in sobriety, but I think this one tops it all. We came, we used the, I did, I would say we, because I could point the finger. Use a MapQuest. I wonder, do they really know what they're doing? You know, I got, after I parked and looked down at, well, I was a ways off and I was talking to Merle, and I looked down at it and it said something to the effect like, this is a guide. So, you know, in other words, it may not be like I took it as, you know, gospel. But anyway, by the grace of God, we made it, and I'm definitely grateful to be here. And I want to thank my, you know, the people that keep me sober, Carmen, Yvette, and Yvette, you know, for, you know, riding along with me. There's not too many people could ride 165 miles with me in the same car. So I'm grateful to have people in my life like that. You know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, or people that are new, let me welcome you and assure you that this program works. And it works one day at a time. If it didn't work, I wouldn't be here. This is approximately, you know, they say you have to be willing to go to any length. This is approximately a half mile beyond any length. You know, and, but I'm here and I'm sober. And that's one thing I can count on is that when the clock strikes midnight, I'll have another day. Because I'm still willing to do whatever it is, you know, for my sobriety. And I have people around me that's willing to do the same thing. So, and for the birthday people before, you know, because I think you guys must celebrate after I finish. So, congratulations. The birthdays were the attraction for me. When I first got sober, I saw somebody take a cake, and it wasn't that, you know, the struggle they went through to get the cake, because I was new. I mean, I'm one of those newcomers. I came in here with no knowledge of Alcoholics Anonymous, no knowledge of the disease, nothing. I didn't know about recovery centers. Everything I learned was from right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I saw somebody taking a birthday cake. I'm like, oh, that's cool, because the whole meeting is focused on that one person. I'm going to get me a cake. The pain and agony, those of us that have taken a cake know the pain and agony that I went through to get that cake. Because I think every human emotion you have, tenfold, every time it comes up and you still don't drink to get that cake. But it's well worth it. And fortunately for me, I haven't drank since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is May 12, 1984. And I'm very grateful. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, there's no other place I could have gone and received the things that I've received here in Alcoholics Anonymous just for not drinking. You know, I'm very grateful. So if you knew, you know, here are the things, like, because I got sober, like I said, in 1984, the places where I got sober was 9604, and them old sisters in play. You know, they didn't care about nothing but you staying sober. They didn't care how bad I thought I was or how cute I thought. They didn't care about none of that. And they tell me, sit down, shut up, and listen. You know, you listen to what we're talking about, because that's what keeps you sober. Because one thing about that separates the new person that's just coming in from the person that's been here is that the person that's been here know exactly what you've gone through, and thank you for coming back to show us that it still hasn't changed out there. But you don't know what we're talking about unless you sit here and listen. And it's not going to hurt you. For the old timer told me she's gone to the big meeting in the sky, Marcy. I happened to sit next to her by mistake when I first got sober. And that lady dictated my life for 9 months from that chair. She said, tomorrow you'll be here at 5:30. I didn't have plans for coming back. Not the next day. But I was scared, as bad as I was scared to tell her, I'm not coming back tomorrow, so I came back the next day. And I sat next to her, and she said, you know, you don't have to be a part of the passing parade. I didn't know what that was. And I was too ashamed to ask her. So I just kept coming back long enough until I understood what she was talking about. But she told me there were some things that I had to do around it. And this is what she told me that really, it really stuck with me and helped me in my first year. She said, you know, Bev, she said, how old are you? And I said 33. At the time, I was 33, many years ago. And she said, well, you know, you're 33. You've been running your life all your life. And you still end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, just give us 1 year. Just give us 1 year. Do everything we ask you to do the first year. And after you take your cake, if you don't like what you've gotten here in Alcoholics Anonymous, go back to doing what you were doing. And, you know, I sat there and I thought, well, that's not a bad thing. I didn't know what I would get in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. And they used to say, if you make a list of the things you want, things that you want to achieve in Alcoholics Anonymous, you would definitely shortchange yourself. And I didn't even understand that. I'm like, I wouldn't shortchange myself. I want a Mercedes. I want a nice home. I don't know how that could shortchange, but that's not what we're talking about. But I'm very materialistic when I got here. Fortunately, Alcoholics Anonymous and the people around me were able to help me with that and help me put things in perspective. I want to thank Merle for asking me to come out and participate. It gives me a chance to participate in my own recovery, and as often as I can do that, I do that. I'm a student by the grace of God, and with the help of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I get to go to school, and I don't get a lot of time to come out and share like I used to before I started school. But you know, I'll be back where I'm supposed to be, hopefully in another year. You know, if it's God's will, unless something else happens, I never know. I just try to show up and do what I'm supposed to do. But I started going to school, and before I get too far in school, what time do I stop? Could you give me a time?
9 o'clock.
Okay, I need, because if you don't give me a time, we'll be here all night. I'm not one of those people that don't have nothing to say. I've been sober for 20. It may not mean nothing to nobody, what I say, but I've been sober for 23 years, and if I don't talk about nothing else but how grateful I am that I'm sober, I could do that from now into the new year, because God has truly blessed me in many, many ways through Alcoholics Anonymous. In 2 more days and 1 month. I'll be 57 years old. And when I got here, I felt 60. You know, they say Alcoholics Anonymous makes you young. And I used to look at the older people who were 57 when I was 33. And I used to say, well, I don't see no youth in them. like some of y'all probably saying about me. Huh? But anyway, I'm just so grateful to be here. Let me tell you, I started going to school. I'm a high school dropout. And so, you know, it was so my family was so insane. I come from an alcoholic family. Now, when I say I come from an alcoholic family, I don't mean everybody drink. I don't think that's really the description of an alcoholic family. An alcoholic family is where one of the parents drink and everybody else is crazy as a result of it. My father was the alcoholic, and my mother was what the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes as neurotic. It says, if you're with an alcoholic over any considerable period of time, you too will become neurotic, and that was my mother. And so she made the whole house crazy. My mother was busy. My father was drinking. My mother was busy trying to get him to not drink, so the kids were neglected. And when it was time to go to school, it wasn't one of my favorite things. So I wasn't a dumb kid or unable to learn. I was preoccupied with the insanity at home or what was going to happen. Because I was incest by my father, my natural father, from the age of 3 to 11, so I didn't want to go home. When I was at school, I wanted my mother to be home. She wasn't necessarily going to be home, and at that young age, I couldn't tell what days of the week she went to work and what days she was at home. So I was always preoccupied. The teacher talking about Beverly, what is 1 and 1? I could care less. I got real problems. You could solve that one, you know. And it's like, I had issues, you know what I'm saying? I got stuff going on at home. I wasn't trying to figure out what your 1 and 1 is, you know. If I was able to, I'd have told the teacher, you help me with my problem, I'll be glad to solve yours. You know, I had real, real issues. And, you know, life was really unfair. And I used to always say, you know, God, why you curse me with those parents? You know, I had a father that abused me and a mother that neglected me. And I used to think, you know, only Alcoholics Anonymous will help you reveal yourself to yourself. Because for all my life, I used to say God curse me with them parents and bless them with me. But if you ask my mother and my father about me, they'd probably say the same thing. God cursed us with you and blessed, you know. So it's perception. That's what we learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't the best child. I was not a bad child. I was very complicated because I was confused because I didn't understand what was going on. And like I said, my father drank, and, you know, their drinking bothered me. You know, their drinking, it really, it seemed like I have three brothers, three sisters. It seemed like I'm the only one that was really affected, you know, to the point where I'm still talking about it. I'm 57, and I'm still talking about how it affected me, because it did. You know, certain things happen in my life, and I have to work constantly. As a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, I get a chance to work constantly to take care of those situations where I don't harm other people or allow them to harm me. And my thing is not being aware of the damage I do to you emotionally or mentally. And then if you do anything to me physically, then I don't play fair. It's not about, you know, the punishment fit the crime. That's why the law system, like, if you do this, you get this amount of time, because that equals that. I don't play fair. And Alcoholics Anonymous is teaching me how to just be, you know, be fair with whatever it is, you know. So I remember one time with my parents, this made the big impression on me. Actually, you know, it's amazing how when you make a decision about anything at any age, because I look at the different people now that are adults and how they always wanted to be a nurse when they grow up, or a doctor, or a pilot, and that's what they are, you know. And I wish I had those type of thoughts when I was little, you know, but I didn't. I was consumed with fear, guilt, and all kind of other stuff. My father, I remember he drank a lot, and this was like a typical weekend at my house. I was born and partially raised in the Watts part of Los Angeles in Nickerson Gardens. And my father, back then they were projects, you know, when you have a upstairs and downstairs, they call them condos and stuff now, but we were in the projects, you know. I still call them projects. Anything I see upstairs, downstairs, and you in the same door, and you connected by one, anyway. I remember one time my parents were fighting, because this is a typical weekend. My father would start drinking. He would be pissy drunk by the end of Friday night. They would start fighting at some point. We spent all day Saturday at the big county general hospital because he done beat my mother up. And then Sunday, and the kids had to stay in the car. Back then it wasn't child abuse or any of that. We had to stay in the car with the window cracked. No matter how hot it was, we could not let the window down or open the door for anybody. Those were the rules, and we always abided by them. And then all day Sunday, we were back at the hospital because they were releasing my mother. And then Monday, they were back in love again up until Friday. And that was just how it went, you know. And I remember I saw when my parents would fight, I would sit at the top of the stairs. It would be dark. You couldn't see me. They didn't know I was there. And I would sit there. And this particular night, I was sitting up there. My father was beating my mother. And I walked down, and I was looking, you know, I was peeping down like that. And he bent her over and he took, he had a razor strap and he started whipping her with a razor strap. And he had a switchblade knife and he put it to her neck. And I, from then on for years, I used to think that my father was going to kill my mother. And so I grew up with that type of fear. Now, let me get it straight for the people that are new. My parents did not cause me to be an alcoholic. That's not what I'm saying. I come up with the reasons to drink. I don't really need that many, but they gave me plenty. You know, one or two would have done it. But they've given me plenty reason to drink. And so I was consumed with fear about that. And I made a decision. I made a decision when I saw him beat my mother that I would never let a man hit me. That would never ever happen to me, that I would not live that life. And we moved out of the projects when I was fairly young. I think I was about 11. We moved to the central part of L.A. and out of the projects. So, you know, I can't really say that my life was one where I really had fun. I was one of those kids that I was always a troubled kid. I was a good kid as far as, like, I used to, you know, if anybody said, well, was Beverly ever a problem or something? I held a lot of stuff, feelings in, held a lot of things in. I was very wise to be so young, and it took away my childhood, that along with all the other stuff that happened, of course. And so I was always doing some adult stuff. I'd rather be sitting in there with the adults than to be outside playing with the kids. And I used to wonder why my life was like it was. I mean, it was just seemed like it was just unfair. And, you know, but nevertheless, that was, you know, the cards I was dealt. And I didn't really have my mother tried to get us in church. I didn't have a good relationship with God, but I believed that there was a God. I couldn't figure out what he was doing with me, and I was too young to interpret, did he abandon me, or, you know, I couldn't get it quite together, but I knew that I believed that there was a God, or that I believed in a God. And I remember when my faith started turning was when my uncle, I had a cousin, it was a guy who was the minister of a church. And my mother used to go there, and because he was a relative, or we was his relative, we used to always have to participate in all the stuff. You know, they have Mother's Day, then we would have to, you know, our mother would dress us up in all these cute clothes, I guess. Cute. And I say feathers, but what are they? Ruffles and hair and pigtails, Shirley Temple curls with 1,000 bows in them. And I wanted to wear some jeans. I didn't really want to be in all that petticoat stuff. And but nevertheless, you know, I was very submissive. And I, you know, we would go, and then we would be in the big speeches and all this. And I remember, this is where I had a problem with God. I wasn't in school yet. And I remember that it was an Easter event at the church. And we were supposed to stand there, all the Sunday school kids, with the letters spelled Happy Easter. And because my uncle was the relative, or cousin was the minister, and I was the oldest girl, and I got the H. And so I had my little speech to go with the H. And this is the problem I had, because my speech was, H is for our house. We make it a happy home. Why do I still remember that 50 years later? I mean, that just goes to show the damage that people do to you. You know what I'm saying? My problem was, okay, my parents got me lying in church. And is God going to punish me? See, that's when I say I was a troubled kid. This is a problem I brought my parents, because they could never figure me out. I mean, most kids would have just went on with the H and kept going. But I'm trying to, like, you know, God is going to get me for standing here lying, because my house is not a happy home. You know, do you really know what's going on in my house? But I couldn't say nothing. You know, I had to go. So that put me and God, that separated us, because I kept saying, you know, I'm going to get in trouble. Because my mother used to always say, you know, God's going to get you for this, God's going to get you for that. And then I'm like, okay, if God's going to get anybody, he's going to get you for not protecting me. I didn't think of that. I thought of that in sobriety. It had to set me free, you know, from all this. It's like God gonna get you. God trying to protect me. Now, I ain't did nothing but held up this big H. You know? Anyway, fortunately, you know, I was able to deal with that in sobriety, and everything that has ever been done displeasing to me, you know, that's why I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been able to turn it around by the grace of God. I took my first drink when I was 16, a fifth of silver satin bitter lemon with a little bit of grape Kool-Aid in it. That's most people's last drink. That was my first. And what happened is I was 16 years old, and this guy came. He was, you know, it's sad. For years, I used to think it was funny until I got sober. He was 19, and he was a neighborhood drunk at 19. He bought the fifth of silver satin bitter lemon, and he gave it to me, and he said, here, take this and put the Kool-Aid in it, shake it up, and share it with your friends. And it was about five of us. Now, if I'd have known anything about the disease of alcoholism, I would have known right then that I had a problem. Because I didn't have to drink it, because you guys taught me that the disease centers in the mind. And when he told me to share it with them, my first thought was, no, I don't want to. But I didn't have a clue what I didn't know what alcohol would do. I'd never drank before. I was never drunk. But it's my thinking around alcohol. I didn't even want to share. So only one of them wanted it, you know, wanted some of it. So I took the bottle, I measured it, and to get my fair share. And I turned the bottle up, my first drink, turned it up. And when it got to the line, she tapped me on the shoulder. And I was more than willing to give it to her at that time. Because what happened is alcohol, the magic had happened for me. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. It took the pain of the past away. And I couldn't believe something so little could be so powerful. And I knew I would drink again. I knew without a shadow of a doubt for what that drink did for me that night. I knew I would drink again. Now, what happened is the consequences of me being drunk, I should have never drank again. But I didn't think about that. I thought about what it did for me initially. And it took the pain of the past, all that was happening with my father and all the fear, the insecurity, the guilt, the shame, all that, it was gone with that one drink. And what happened is I was in a corner fourplex, and I lived three houses down the back side street. And that night after I drank and got drunk, trying to get home, I must have slept with Tom, Dick, and Harry. It didn't even faze me. And I didn't think about who were they or what are people going to say? All I could think about is that drink took the pain of the past away, and I knew I would drink again. And the thing about the disease, what's so cold about it, is what it makes me do in between trying to get back to that okay place. See, I didn't plan to go to jail. I'm not a jail person. Some people can go to jail, and they'd be like, okay, I'll be out in a couple of days, and they just, or a week or a month. And they just deal with it, and when their time come to get out, they're out. But not me. From the time they lock me on that side of the gate to the time they release me to this side, I'm totally restless, irritable, and discontent, and I'm making noise, and I'm yelling, and I'm screaming. I'm letting them know they got the wrong person. They need to let me out of here. You know, I just cause a lot of confusion. And I'm grateful today that I was never able to be content in jail. Because I know I had a lot of friends that was okay. They said, you know what, I'm just doing 6 months. 6 months? 6 months and locked up with somebody telling you when, where, and how to do? Oh, I would have to kill myself. I would have to kill myself. And what happened is I went to jail twice, a direct result of drinking. You know, I was driving. I had a friend of mine was helping me clean up the garage, and I took her home. She lived about maybe 12 miles away from where I lived. And back then, if I drove you somewhere, dropped you off somewhere, I didn't want gas money. I needed gas money. She gave me about two Valiums. That was my, you know, normally it would have been my gas money. And I took the Valiums and I popped the beer. And she said, Bev, no, wait till you go home. And my denial, the disease had me thinking a certain way. You know, it really, it sets you up. When I look back over my inventory, my disease have me becoming the biggest fool I've ever known. And I sit there and I'm a fool in action and don't even know it. You know, I'm sitting there saying, no, and I just take it and drink the beer. And I say, by the time I get home and take a shower, get into bed, then it'll take effect. That's insanity. That's embarrassing to think that I believe that. But when I'm drinking, I believe all kind of lies that I tell myself to keep me drinking. Because my disease is out to kill me. It sets me up. And I don't know it's setting me up. And so I took those pills and I turned that cold can of Budweiser, and I got 10 blocks, 15 blocks, no more than 15 down the street, and had an accident with the center divider. And my car was not drivable. And I get out the car, and it wasn't drivable. The wheel was turned, you know. So I saw a bus bench, and I was just drunk. And I saw a bus stop bench. It was a boys' market then. And my what I was planning on doing is crossing the street and sit on the bus bench and hitchhike home. But I got in the middle of the street. But since I was going to hitchhike anyway, a car was coming. It was nighttime. I saw headlights. I just flagged the car down. And it was the LAPD. It was my first trip to Civil Brand. It was the most humiliating experience I've ever had in my life. And even it's not so much of going to jail, but the process of being under arrest. You know, they didn't do anything that they weren't supposed to do. It's just humiliating. You standing there and they put a cuff on you and put your hand behind your back, and then they take this one and put it with that one and lock your hands. You know, I lost my choices. I didn't know it till they clinked the last cuff. I didn't know I had choices till I had lost them. And if it was up to me, my preference would have been, you know, if you got to handcuff me, would you do it in the front, please? But they didn't give me no choice. They didn't ask me that. Because when you drive and drunk, or you under the influence, you don't really have choices. Nobody want to ask you too much of anything. It's just, you know, even if I was right, I'm wrong if I'm drunk. And that's what I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so they wanted me to get in their car. I didn't want to get in their car. I have a car. I have a new car. It just was in a little accident. A brand new car. And they tried to get me in their car, and I talk a lot when I'm drunk. And as they tried to get me in their car, I put my foot on the base of the police car. I said, wait a minute. You didn't stop me. I stopped you. It didn't matter. It didn't matter. I went on down the Silver Brand. I was humiliated, but, you know, the procedures weren't finished. They fingerprinted me and took pictures and had me get in the shower. They had me take off all my clothes and get in the shower. And I'm like, because I've never been in jail before. Up to that point, I had never been in any trouble. And they wanted me to take a shower, and I was trying to explain to them that I had just taken a shower. But that wasn't their point. Their purpose wasn't to get me clean, but I didn't know that. And when I got wet enough, you know, they bent me over and sprayed me, you know, like an animal. To me, that was the height of my humiliation. You know, I was bum drunk and knew I had been humiliated. And I sat in Civil Brand and I told myself I'll never, ever put myself in a position to be treated like this again. And that's the first truth I told myself in many years, was that I put myself in that position. You know, and I, you know, as humiliated as I was, it, you know, that whole process, and I said I would never do it. Of course I would do it again. Of course. I never acknowledged how I got there in the first place. I didn't sit in Civil Brand and say, you know, Bab, because you're drinking, you're here. If you don't want to come back, you need to do something about your drinking. I was clueless. I didn't want to go back, but I didn't know how to not go back, because I didn't know that alcohol was what got me there. Because remember, it was the best thing that ever happened to me when it took the pain of the past away. It was doing it for me. And I didn't know I had crossed that invisible line, and now it was doing it to me. And I didn't know. And so what I did is I got out, and as happy as I was to be out, I was celebrating. When it got a little bitty short short one, cold can of Budweiser, but I learned in here in Alcoholics Anonymous years later that it's the first drink that gets you drunk. I didn't know that. I probably wouldn't have picked up that first one. I don't know. I'll never know. But I know today that it's the first one. And I know I don't pick it up today. But that little short can of Budweiser had me right back in Silverbrand in less than 30 days. I couldn't bear to be in there the 7 hours in the holding tank. And I set myself up there to be there as I stand here tonight. And I went right back in there less than 30 days, this time for attempted murder. And my disease is cold. The very thing I say I'm not going to do when I take a drink is the first thing I do. You know, I was married. I probably never should have gotten married for many, many reasons. And the main reason that I don't think I should have got married is because my parents were the only people that I watched as far as a relationship go. I had no relationship skills, none. I didn't know how to care about anybody. I didn't care about myself. And I should have never put that on that man. But, you know, I was cute. He wanted me. He had a job and a car. I wanted stuff and things. And so we got together and managed to be together for 15 years and had two wonderful kids out of the deal. Have twin boys there, 32 years old, and I have one grandson. My ex-husband died last year. I'm not going to say from what because I really don't know. Because they don't tell me. They don't want me to know because I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm the alcoholic, so we don't know what he died from. You're only alcoholic if you say you're one. I can't, you know, diagnose you for you. But when we had those kids, and, it was a time that I was just really drinking bad, and for like a six-month period in my life, it's the only time in my life where I didn't draw a sober breath for six consecutive months. And he used to always threaten to take the kids from me. And we were separated, like we were after 9 years, we started to separate, and I'm going to divorce you. No, we get back together, and buy me a car, I'll stay with you, you know, or a diamond ring. And, you know, that's how I was just sick. You know, just insane, because that's all I knew, is that to get stuff and stuff. My mother never said, you know, Bev, you know, when you grow up, you know, you need to, you know, make sure you get a good education in case you decide to have children and get married and something don't work out, you'll be able to take care of yourself. And her whole thing was make sure you look good because you got to get a man that's going to take care of you. And, you know, my husband, he was a good guy. He was really a good guy. He had a drinking problem, but he was a good father, and he was a good husband. He was a very good provider. I'm the one, he has some idea of how to do a relationship. I'm the one that had no idea. I had no idea. I was married, but I didn't want to stay home. I didn't want to take my vacation when I was working on when the kids were out of school. I didn't want to do none of that. I wanted to run around and hang out and, you know, spend money. And fortunately, he was one of those type of people that, you know, he just loved me unconditional. You know, he didn't have any real holes on me. He wanted a wife that had where he could come home to a house, his home, and he was willing to be a good provider and provide all that. But me, on the other hand, I don't know. I was just not. I look back now when I've done my inventories and I look at, you know what? How did you ever even get connected with anybody close enough to say I do? I was so way out there. And you know, during this period, he came by and he said he came to take the kids to safety. Because he had been by there and I was drunk and I couldn't take care of him. He said, I don't really recall not being able to take care of him. But I mean, you know, I might not have been taking care of him as well as I normally do. But he thought that they needed help. And that's all he was doing. I thought he was taking the kids away from me. And so he started pushing me around. And he, you know, I used to say when I was newer in sobriety, I used to say he hit me. And for me, I say he hit me because I used to say that. I used to lie. That's really what it was. I used to lie because it justified my part. But it doesn't matter, even if he did hit me, even if he socked me. You know, I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, I still had no right to react the way that I did. But it's what I did. You know, he hit me. We was in this house, and I loved this house. Was magazine laid. It was two bedrooms, and, you know, my stuff and I were one. I was more materialistic. I was more into my stuff. You know, I had a black shag carpet in the kitchen. I had a stereo in my refrigerator door. I had a living room set, had it made. A table by one of the designers, had white shag carpet in the bedroom on an orange suede bedroom set. My stuff and I were one. Don't mess with my stuff. I care more about my stuff than my family. And I didn't realize that until I did my inventory. And I remember he came in and he started pushing me. And what I started thinking about was my parents and voices. I mean, I was so out of it. Voices started saying, you know, this is what happened to your mother. This is what happened to your mother. Your father pushed her once, and look how they ended up. He started beating her, and if you don't stop him, that's what's going to happen to you. And it was loud and clear to me. You know, it was loud and clear. And I went in the bedroom, and I got a gun. I said, God, if you come back and hit me again, I'm going to shoot him. And he came back and hit me, and I shot him. Now, to show you, the book talks about it doesn't matter how far down the scale we've gone. We see where our experience can benefit others. This may not be your experience. I don't want it to be a secret of mine. It's been too long. But when I looked at him bleeding on my white shag carpet, I put the gun to the head and said, get up. You bleeding on the carpet. And that's how much I didn't care. I did not have the will to care about another person. And that's how the disease is cold like that. I was more concerned about my stuff. He was not like I was. I told you, he was made of something a little bit different, thank God. Because the police came, and he went to the hospital, because they came with the ambulance stuff, and he went to the hospital, and they stayed at his door for 3 days trying to, with a paper and a pen. See, just sign. You don't ever have to worry about her again. Sign right here. But he told him, he said, I can't do that. He said, that's the mother of my kids. I can't do that. And I love that man for that. I didn't love him then, and I didn't know how, but I love him today for that. Because if he'd have signed, I probably would not be here tonight. But I'm going to tell you what's true. If it was me, I would have signed. Because that's where I was at that time. And see, here's my message in that is, if you have issues as a kid, if you're abused, then don't pretend that certain things you won't do. Don't pretend your way through Alcoholics Anonymous. Get real with it, because you're as sick as your secrets. See, I'm not the same person that I came in here. I'm not the same person. So I don't have those dark secrets haunting me, but they did for years. I would never tell nobody that. I was ashamed of feeling that way. But I drank for many years behind that kind of stuff. And I don't hide who I am today. And God put people in my life today who love me and who know me. And to know me is to love me, because I do. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, how to love myself. Because I've had a lot of bad behavior. But it was because I was in my disease. And the only reason I know that is because I'm not in my disease now, and I don't have that behavior. I don't have nothing that reflects that behavior. I went to jail the mandatory 3 days. They were supposed to release me the first day, but they were trying to get him. I stayed in the mandatory 3 days. And when I got out of there, you know, we were broke up, but we got back together, because that was just an incident in the Harris home. You know, just another chapter, because we always had all kind of stuff going on. But it didn't make me think, wow, you know, Bev, this is serious here now. Now you're going to jail and shooting people. You know, this is some serious. It didn't make me think like that. The disease had me going so far out there that I didn't even think about. I couldn't compare that this is worse, that I'm getting worse, that my disease is progressing. I didn't have what it takes to distinguish that. And so I went on, hurt myself and others for another 3 or 4 years until I believe it's God's will that I was to find the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to tell you, because once I got here, I felt like this is where I belong. Even though I didn't understand nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt at home here. I didn't feel like I don't need to be here or why they got me. I mean, I had my questions. I'm not saying I didn't. But I felt good about being here. And I got here by way of 3 major surgeries in a 5-week period. I was down to 90 pounds, and I thought I was dying. I was laying at Cedars-Sinai Hospital, and even that husband, a few other family members came to visit me. And my kids were very young. And I used to always ask God, please, God, just, you know, I know I'm tripping, but just let me live to see my kids get grown, because I want to raise them a certain way, and I don't want them to experience nothing that I've experienced. So once they get grown, then if it's my time, I'm ready. And I found myself in that hospital, and this particular time I was back in there, and I was laying there, my stomach was swelling, and I was watching it. It was swelling. I looked like I was about 6 months pregnant, and I was turning dark, and I knew within my spirit I was dying. And I had what I call then a religious experience, because when I came in here, I'm a born again Christian. I'm still, that's my religious faith. I believe that for religion, but I believe Alcoholics Anonymous for recovery right here, right now. And I was laying in the bed, and my spirit came through the mattress, and I looked at them, and I looked at myself. And I shook my head at myself. I said, it's a shame, girl, you're getting ready to die. You never had a chance to live. And I said, God, I promise you this more times than I care to admit, but if you get me out of this, I'll change my life. And I didn't know how I would do it, but when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. I had a sister in Al-Anon and a brother-in-law in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sister had been trying to 12-step me for a long time. And she had given up, because in Al-Anon, they let you do it so long and then you stop. So she had left me alone. And finally she called me one day. I was talking to her, and she was going to a meeting, and I asked her, could I go? And the miracle happened for me. She told me to meet her at the Crenshaw Lionel Club, and I went to her house, and we went over there. I went to Al-Anon for 11 months. I started getting high in the Crenshaw Lionel bathroom. And then a woman in the Al-Anon meeting said, Babe, she was an alcoholic. She said, you don't have to live like that. You've been around here, and you don't have to live like that. You know what to do about your problem. And I made a decision, and I went into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous about maybe a couple of weeks or so after that. And some of the things I heard, I don't really know. I just remember, I don't know if it's the first week, the first meeting, the first month. But some of the things I heard that still holds me today is, this is the best step you'll ever take from the cradle to the grave, the day you stepped into Alcoholics Anonymous, to take responsibility for your life. And that's not why I came in here, but that's exactly what happened. They told me to take the steps off the wall and incorporate them in my daily living, and I've been able to do that. You know, I realized I was powerless when I was sitting at home one day. I didn't understand it, and the little lady told me, she said, just take a walk back through memory lane in the quietness of your own room at night. You know, when you just laying there, think about your drinking. Just look at when every time you got in trouble, was alcohol present? You know, every time you went to jail, was alcohol present? And every time I did that, it was for me. But I remember when I was in control, what I call in control of alcohol, was when I was at the house, and my husband would go to work, and I would get up and clean up the house and half cook dinner and then turn it off and then get the kids situated and call my homegirls over, and we would sit down and drink all day. And when an hour before time for him to come, I'd get them out, clean up, get the kids bathing ready, and then finish cooking the dinner. And he think I've been at home chilling all day, being the perfect housewife. And then, you know, the disease progressed. So what happened is I stopped calling my friends. They was drinking up all my liquor. And I stopped calling them. But what's more worse than that is I remember when I would sit down and I would be drinking and I would have to go to the bathroom and I'd set the glass down and go to the bathroom. But the day came when I couldn't set it down. I would just take it with me. And then the incomprehensible demoralization when I couldn't even get up to go. And so I could look at my own life and see where my disease progressed. You know, I realized I have no power, no control over alcohol. Once it's in me, I can't predict what I'll do. And when I think I want to take one drink and just chill at home, if I take the one drink, I may end up anywhere. Like in Sybil Brand for attempted murder. And I have to keep that in mind because I didn't plan to go there. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. They told me to take the steps off the wall and incorporate them in my life. They say the steps are numbered for the intellect. You do them in order. You do 1, 2, 3, you just do them in order. Because that's how they're designed to do. I'm going to jump right quick for time's sake. I did a third step. I did them in order. I did my third step, and I remember trying to get, you know, I'm like, okay, I really believe this. God is my witness. I thought I came in here because when I start hearing people talk about higher power, God as I understand, I'm like, oh, God, this is why you got me in here, to help these people understand who you really are. And that's what I believe, that I knew the truth. And that I'm here to grace you all with it. And what happened is I was sitting and I kept hearing these people, God, well, mine is an airplane. It's more powerful than me. I'm like, God, come on. And what happened is, as I sat there with my judgmental, born again, know who God is self, what I realized, because God kept telling me, not yet, Bev, your day is coming, but just wait. I'm gonna let you tell them what's going on, but just wait. The more I waited, the more I could hear. Because I had to hear to make sure who I had to go convert. And I realized, you know what? This person with the doorknob and that person with the airplane, and this one don't even know their God, calling a higher power, they seem to be more happy on the inside. And I was missing that. I was missing that. And as I went home one day, I said, God, you know what? Why am I there to help them when they seem to be a little bit more happy? I'm missing something. And it was revealed to me that God could be whatever you decide God is for you. Because I'm so many different depending on who you ask. If you ask my kids, I'm mom. If you ask my sister, I'm sis. If you ask my mother, I'm daughter. If you know, I'm my niece, I'm auntie. It depends on who you're talking to, what they call me. Yet I'm just one. And it was revealed to me with God, and I was able to accept God as being the doorknob. He could be all. It's all inclusive. I did an inventory. When I finished the inventory, I prayed and asked this lady, would she listen to it? And as I was reading it, she was writing. When she finished, I said, what's that? She said, here. I said, well, what is it? She said, this is your character defect list and your amends list. I looked at her with, of course, great disagreement. I said, you know, my friends make their own list. She said, yeah, Bev, that may very well be true. But you're incapable of being honest with yourself. And I'm like, wow, did she insult me? And alcohol, they mess you up in here. They say it's a new language. So I'm like, did she? I wasn't sure, but I told her, I said, if you insulted me, I'm going to get back with you. She was absolutely right. She had my dad's name on the amends list. I couldn't figure out. Did I tell you what he did to me? What you mean I owe him an amends? She said, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. In here, we deal with our side of the street. I wouldn't have no side if it wasn't for his side. And I made that clear to her. She said, Bev, I'm going to tell you, you can bark, you can do whatever you're going to do. She said, but in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't care what the other person did. She says, is there anything you did to your father that's not okay to do to anybody just walking down the street? I'm like, yeah, then make amends for that. So as my father died from the disease, and I started writing this letter, that's the way I was directed, and She told me, she said, say everything you ever want to say to him, but before you close, make an amends for your behavior towards him. And I was writing, and, you know, I said, you know, you can say what you're going to say, but, you know, look what you did to me, destroyed my life, made me an alcoholic, because I believed that at the time. And I said, you can't blame it on you being an alcoholic because, you know, I'm an alcoholic, the worst thing I've ever done, and it was revealed to me. I had forgotten about it, and God revealed it to me at that very moment. And I started crying. I said, God, please forgive me. And a voice said, you want me to forgive you, but you're unwilling to forgive. And I had to change my attitude about my father. And I had to forgive my father for what the harm he had caused me. Because I wanted God to forgive me for the harm that I had caused others. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous worked. You know, that may not have been my problem. That may not have been my issue. But for me, it was in my way. And God moved it for me so that I could become a full member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So that I could see that my disease is not connected to what my parents did or didn't do, or who protected me or who didn't. I'm an alcoholic because when I take a drink, things happen different for me than they do with the normal person. And it has nothing to do with anything else. You know, fortunately for me, and I was in Alcoholics Anonymous when, I'm going to close with this, when I got sick a few times, I've had 12 major surgeries in sobriety. I had breast cancer. I'm a competitive bodybuilder. So when I had breast cancer and they wanted to remove my left breast, and, you know, people say, well, what you going to do, Ben? Nothing. What am I going to do? I'm going to do nothing. What do I have coming that I can't give up a left breast that's infected with cancer? What is wrong? I'm way overpaid in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 10 years sober at that time. You know, thank God it's a breast. I got another one. Actually, they put it back. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, I had kidney cancer. I had a mass on my kidney. They took a kidney. Oh, babe, they took your kidney? You know you need two kidneys. No, they say, you don't need but one kidney. I said, no, you need two. You can live with one, but you need two. But you know what? By the grace of God, it's by the grace of God that I'm here and as healthy as I am. I could have lost an eye, an arm, a leg. You know, why should I cry over spilled milk? Look at the damage that I've caused other people, the harm that I've done to other people. Look at the love that I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous, the support. People forgive me. You know, I dare not. I don't want to be anybody else in here. I have my cross to bear. I know what my road is like. I wouldn't trade my life for yours or nobody else's. I remember one day I came in a meeting, a marathon. I had on a cat suit because I'm a competitive bodybuilder, so I could wear that stuff. I'm getting older now. I'm a little more selective. And this lady said, oh, wow, I wish I had that body. I said, no, you don't, because you don't have a clue what this body been through. You know, she was clueless. You know, after I got through with that, I decided to get back in shape to go do some competitions. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous taught me to show up no matter what. Show up for yourself, babe. So I went to do this competition. It's about 4 or 5 20-some-year-olds. And here I am. But, you know, I work for mine, like they say in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you earned your seat. You know, that's your seat. Don't care who's sitting next to you. So I did my thing. You know, at 51 years old, I won the competition over the 4 20-some-year-olds with one breast and one kidney. Do they know that I have missing parts? They don't know that I have missing parts, because Alcoholics Anonymous told me, they said, you just show up and do what you're supposed to do. And don't worry about the next person. And don't reveal what don't have to be revealed. You know, God is good. I want to tell you all, I love you. You know, if nobody told you they love you today, I do. For no other reason than you taught me how to love and you gave me a new life. Thank you so much.